Why pick this fight? Donald Trump billing April 2nd as Liberation Day, where the United States sheds the shackles of unfair competition thanks to worldwide tariffs. We'll test the veracity of the U.S. president's worldview and ask, how much is theatrics that will play well in constituencies where manufacturing have disappeared? How much is a genuine sense of grievance? Or has the world's top superpower simply grown tired of playing guarantor of global free trade? Otherwise, why test the rules of globalization when you already dominate global tech and financial services? In the short term, the United States can inflict a lot of pain. After all, it controls the world's most trusted currency, the almighty U.S. dollar. Is that trust gone and gone for good? Even if it's all bargaining tactics and Donald Trump ultimately rolls back those tariffs, what will happen next? Today in the France 24 debate, we're asking if it's strictly business or has trust in the U.S. eroded for good. With us from Arlington, Virginia, political economist Véronique de Rugy, senior research fellow with George Mason University's Mercatus Center. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.
Thank you for having me.
Francesco Saracino is deputy director of the OFCE think tank. He divides his teaching duties between Sciences Po in Paris and Lius University in Rome. Welcome back.
Thank you for inviting me.
Welcome back as well to entrepreneur Nicolas Mélan, former scientific advisor to the French government strategy board, France Stratégie.
Yes.
Good to see you.
Good evening, François.
You can listen, that's right, listen, like, and subscribe to the France 24 debate wherever podcasts are streamed. Now, you can argue about Donald Trump's trade policy acumen, and we will, but not his ability to talk up a big announcement. The White House on Tuesday, on the eve of the announcement of these tariffs, eager to highlight the timing of the big day.
He's talked a lot about April 2nd as Liberation Day in America. It would be taking place today if not for April Fool's Day, but tomorrow will be the day.
April Fool's Day, Francesco Saracino. Are we making too much of this? Is this all just a bit of theater?
No, I don't think so. I think, as you said in the introduction, the world order has been challenged by the Trump administration, not only by the way in trade matters. I mean, it seems that they have a whole range of strategies aimed at changing the playground, if you want. It's not very clear, as of now, who they think should be their main targets. They've been targeting, strangely, the countries that less harm them, so Europe, Canada, Mexico, some Latin American countries, but they so far have been sparing mostly China for reasons that are interesting to maybe investigate. But, I mean, a short answer to your question is this is a big deal. This is a big deal because it risks changing the way we conduct not just business, but geopolitics in the next few years.
And there's a lot of nervousness. Spare a thought, if you will, for that favorite French brandy, which the French don't drink so much anymore. 98% of cognac is, in fact, exported. Its two biggest markets just happen to be the United States and China. So, Dateline, the western Charente region of France and the village of Manx-Gondeville, where vintner Mathieu Augier fears the worst if he's priced out of the U.S. market.
The United States is 50% of our market, so tomorrow it's 50% of our sales, it's 50% of our contracts with the trading houses we serve. That's just going to collapse.
Véronique de Rugy, what are French people telling you where you are?
I don't really talk to French people here, but I can tell you that there's a lot of anxiety over Liberation Day. I think a lot of people who understand economics understand that Liberation Day is more like liberating us from prosperity and causing trouble where none is required.
Causing trouble where none is required? There must be, if he's making these moves, he must be doing it for at least a sounds political reason. There must be those who support it.
Polls in the U.S. show that Americans do not support tariffs. Over 65% of people are against tariffs. A vast majority of Americans believe it's going to raise prices. If this president has a mandate to lower prices, not raise prices, we're coming out of 4 years of pretty high inflation. And so I think this is not going to be a popular move. What may save him is the fact that trade, after all, is only a small share of our economy. And so the shock may not be as fast and deeply felt as it is. But it is misguided in the sense that it's rooted in a sense of nostalgia for a life where manufacturing was a big share of our economy, and the belief that somehow you can turn back the clock and put a lot of people back in manufacturing jobs, jobs that have disappeared because of increase of productivity and technology. And I think everyone's going to be disappointed all around.
Everyone's going to be disappointed all around. Or again, I'll put it to you, Nicolas Miron. Is this all a bit of jockeying for position? Yes, he references William McKinley, who was president around the turn of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. But he, at the same time, is it just about leverage? In fact, the United States has big tech. It's got financial services. Is this just a way to leverage when it comes to things like manufacturing?
I think it's the logical continuation of what he started to do back in 2016. He's always loved tariff. I think he said it's his favorite word in the dictionary. Back in 2018, he wanted to put 25% tariff on German cars. And we get a deal with Jean-Claude Juncker where we exchange no tariff on German cars against shale gas from the US plus soja OGM. So it's the continuation. And the truth is, industry, manufacturing is good job, well-paid job, and it creates indirect jobs. And so the US, Trump, and then Biden started to re-industrialize the United States. It's this, like, industry region, of course, China is, industry is big. Europe, it's terrible. But in the US, we can see that they managed to create jobs on semiconductors, on batteries, on electric vehicles. Why? Because they put some very specific tariffs on electric vehicles. Trump put 25% on electric cars from China. What did Biden do? Multiply this by 4 to 100%. There is not a single car coming from China sold in the US. It's not exactly the case that we have now in Europe, even if it's limited. So there are, if you want to put back some manufacturing, you have to protect yourself from low-cost country. That's what they're doing. Will, if they impose, we don't know what he's going to announce tonight, if he impose a global tariff on every product, it probably won't be as efficient as what it did when it's very specific on the technology that he want to bring back to the U.S.
And those Biden policies when it comes to going green also impacted Europe, Francesco Saracino. So is this a continuation or a break, what Donald Trump is announcing?
I go in the direction of what Nicolas was just saying. I mean, I think it's a break because personally, I think that a certain amount of trade protection, targeted and strategic in sectors in which you need to protect them for whatever reason, because they're too small to compete, because they're strategic for geopolitical reasons, whatever reason you have. But if you target your protection on specific sectors and specific countries because you have specific objectives, that is as good as many other instruments you can use to try to boost your economy. Then I totally agree, bringing back jobs is not going to be a large-scale thing because these jobs are gone forever, and the Biden attempt to reindustrialize is working not so well because it's impossible to reverse if you want the trend. But, what the break is, not so much in the use of tariffs, but in this sort of indiscriminate use of tariffs, which, of course, completely goes against what I just said. And I think the main reason why he does that is because he's trying to bully other countries. I mean, he's trying to use tariffs not as a tool to boost some strategic sectors, but is using tariffs as a tool to assess his power in the sort of transactional vision he has of international relations. I show you I'm strong, and then you get, make me concessions. He will probably, I mean, if the others fight back, he will probably, in the end, go in reverse, because I'm not sure he's going to win this war.
All right, and again, we showed the example of that vintner in the Cognac region. We've got good news for him, though. The French foreign minister is just back from Shanghai, where he's gotten a 3-month stay of execution on reciprocal import duties by China on cognac. Those follow EU tariffs on Chinese-made electric vehicles. The Chinese have been on a charm offensive. Over the weekend, there was a meeting with leaders of Japan and South Korea. And last week, the Chinese president telling business leaders to come back and invest. The water is fine.
A tree grows tall because its roots are in fertile soil. For years, China has been a major contributor to and a stabilizer of global economic growth. China is advancing its modernization in an all-round way. The stage is large, the market prospects are broad, the policy expectations stable, and the security situation good. This is fertile ground for foreign enterprises to invest.
Nicolas Ménand, the Chinese to the rescue of French cognac?
You know, cognac was at some point the most favorite drink in nightclubs in China. I mean, they had so many very, very good years. And it's true that only 1% of it, we drink it in France and we sell it to China. Well, you know...
When you hear, more seriously, when you hear Xi Jinping saying, come back and invest, at the time when Donald Trump is talking about tariffs.
Well, you know, we, as far as we are concerned in Europe, it has to be the other way around. Actually, what we need is China to come to us and invest. What we did 20, 30 years ago in China, where we went there, we shared the technology, we transferred the technology to them. Now we need their technology, because if you look at electric cars, if you look at batteries, if you look at solar panels, they have the technology and we need it and we should. And there's some interesting example. If you just take, for example, you know, a couple of years ago, European Commission putting some import tariff was something nobody could imagine. But they did it. They did it a couple of months ago on electric cars, 50%. 50% tariffs on China electric cars. What happened, for example, is that Stellantis just announced that they will build a plant with CATL, which is one of the biggest battery manufacturers in China. So we need Chinese to build their plants in Europe. And being French, if it's in French, I would rather, obviously. We've invested the last 20, 30 years in China. Now it's their come.
Véronique de Rugy, this is all just part of the leveling of the playing field, this three-ring circus between China, the European Union, the United States. Everybody does tariffs at some point. Or are we into something more ominous, a complete reshuffling of the cards when it comes to global trade?
Listen, it depends what you're doing and why you're doing it for and how you're doing it. So if we're doing things for national security reason, it's one thing. If you're doing it for a geopolitical reason, it's another thing. If you're doing to protect your industries, you have to understand that it's very likely not going to yield the results that you think it will, especially in rich countries like the U.S., where our specialty when it comes to labor is like more automation, because we want higher productivity. And most of our economy is a service economy. I think it's 79% of the economy is a service economy. But if you want... If the whole point of this negotiation is to actually get other countries to lower their tariffs, I think putting tariffs on our own consumer is the wrong way to go about it. Go through the WTO. It's not because other countries are penalizing their consumers with higher prices by imposing tariffs that the right strategy is for us to do the same and punish our consumers. I just don't see the logic of this whole thing. And by the way, you've talked about President McKinley. I mean, he ended up regretting the trade wars. And he ended up saying what we economists know, which is no one wins a trade war. Because what ends up happening is what happened last time around with Trump. It's like everyone raises their tariffs. They often are not lifted. You don't get the reduction in trade deficit that they claim they want. You don't get the outcome that you claim you want. And everyone is worse off. This is not the way to go about it.
All right, joining our conversation from New York City, former U.S. State Department advisor on sanctions, Edward Fishman, the author of Choke Points, American Power in the Age of Economic Warfare. You are a senior research scholar at Columbia University Center on Global Energy Policy. Welcome to the France 24 debate on what Donald Trump has branded as Liberation Day. Thanks for joining the conversation.
Yeah, thanks for having me here. Good to be here today.
Your thoughts on this. Again, is this just, as we were saying earlier, continuity? Tariffs have been used as a lever throughout the history of globalization, and this is nothing new? Or are we at a tipping point where this is something different?
I do think this is something different. You know, throughout American history, presidents have used tariffs for economic reasons, as other people have said, for raising government revenue, going back to the very early part of the American Republic, or protecting strategic industries like the electric vehicle industry, which, as a previous commenter has said, Joe Biden himself put 100% tariffs on Chinese electric vehicles. I think what's different about what Trump is doing is levying tariffs, not just against very strategic areas or not just against American adversaries, but against really everyone, allies, adversaries alike. And I think the danger of this approach is that if you're a U.S. business, the only really plausible investment strategy you can have with so much uncertainty about who will be tariffed today and who might be tariffed tomorrow is investing domestically in the United States. And so I think what we wind up having is sort of backsliding into a version of autarky, which for the American economy will put significant restraints on growth, could lead to significant inflation, and ultimately scarcity. So I'm quite worried about this approach. And I think even going beyond the economic ramifications, what history has shown is that when we do have autarky that is prevailing, the risk of war goes up substantially because states don't feel confident that they can just acquire the markets and resources they need through open trade.
Are you sure, Edward, that it's a will to return to autarky? Because Donald Trump, as we see with the omnipresence of Elon Musk by his side, is in with the tech crowd. It's a reminder to the rest of the world that the United States dominates the tech sector. It dominates financial services. Is this just leveraging his might, taking the veneer off of what U.S. power is and making it into something a little bit more, how do I say it, transactional?
Look, I mean, one thing I explore in my book, Choke Points, is how decision making was made in the first Trump administration. And I think it's illustrative for what you're seeing happen now, because Trump allows quite a bit of policy entrepreneurialism, where there are different factions who have different visions for what they're trying to pursue. And while I agree with you that there is this sort of tech bro faction where Elon Musk is really the poster child, the actual officials who are in charge of the levers of American power, be it the Treasury Department, the Commerce Department, the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative, they are much more solidly behind tariffs and a hawkish China strategy than, for instance, their predecessors were even in the first Trump administration. So I think it's a really important question. You know, does Elon Musk have staying power? Is he really going to be around? And is he going to be able to influence policy beyond just sort of being a whisperer in Trump's ear? Because I think if that's really a short-term thing, I do think we ultimately could see more prolonged tariffs. I think the bigger check on Trump's tariff strategy isn't going to be the tech bros. It's going to be what happens ultimately with the market reaction. If Trump comes out with these Liberation Day tariffs today and you see a giant collapse in stock prices that then's prolonged and you wind up seeing that eat into his popularity here in the United States, maybe you will see him reverse course. But I don't think it's going to be Elon Musk who's the restraint on Trump's policies.
All right. Economist Justin Wolfer is over, not X, but Blue Sky, pointing out that if you make an overall average of each country's tariffs, those who'd be hardest hit by reciprocal tariffs would not be the Europeans here seated, but the likes of India, South Korea, and Brazil. They would be the ones who would be hardest hit by this, Francesco Saracino. So again, it's that question. In fact, there, as we see the graph there, how much this is an average of what tariffs look like right now. Obviously, it's different sector by sector, and there would be the graph if the most likely Trump proposal was put into effect. So. What does that imply for the likes of India and Brazil?
What I think, I mean, to just go back to what was said before and to partially answer your question, I think that what might happen, what should happen, what will happen probably, is that the rest of the world will not just stand still and look at what, and let Trump do it. Okay, so we saw Korea, Japan, and China trying to reach an agreement to defuse a little bit this quote-unquote attack by Trump. We see the European Union pushing back yesterday the von der Leyen speech. We saw Canada and Mexico pushing back. So what might happen, we will see probably American firms going back because it's the only way to try to reduce a little bit policy uncertainty. So what we might see is that basically the rest of the world starts doing without the United States as much as they can. Is that going to happen tomorrow? No, because we strongly depend on the U.S. on many sectors. You mentioned, of course, the tech industry. You mentioned finance. There's also defense. So there are a number of sectors in which we don't get rid of the United States in 6 months. But eventually, if the United States start playing, power balance and bullying other countries, the other countries will organize themselves without the United States. So in the medium to long run, that might be a huge cost for the United States. I totally agree with what, sorry, I don't remember your name.
Edward
said in his intervention. Absolutely.
All right. And that brings us to this question of bullying. Europe, Invest in America says, Trump, what's the quality of doing business there going forward? There was a shock over the weekend when the U.S. Embassy in Paris sent out letters to more than three dozen French companies that do business with the United States government, ordering them to pledge that they're not applying diversity, equality, inclusion policies on their boards. Turns out the letters went out all over the European Union.
I would hope that the Danish companies have some stamina and are ready to stand up for the values they fight for and believe in. But I also recognize that this is a really, really difficult situation.
It's not just about economics, Nicolas Ménon. This is when you start telling companies that do business with the United States government that they can't have diversity policies inside of their companies. What's going to be the long-term impact of that?
Well, you know, obviously it's obviously a big change compared to what was done before with Biden. I think Trump is just testing the world. He's testing the world on a couple of topics. He's testing Europe on NATO. He's testing the world on tariff and then on what someone could call wokeist or anti-wokeist policy and see how they react. And eventually he's going to have a bunch of different cards that he wants to play and he might mix different games together. You know, maybe one could imagine that the tariff is putting on Europe, you know, Germany would be in bad shape with 25% tariff on its car because it's basically European balance, positive balance is car sold from Germany to the US and China.
He's testing.
He's testing and but, he might use it for Europe to...
But how do Europeans think? Oh, he's just testing, let's just wait it out? America's changed and changed for good?
No, I wrote a paper about this and I said that Trump is a chance for all the other countries in the world that can finally wake up, put their arm together. And for Europe, for example, I said Trump might help Europe to reindustrialize, because otherwise Europe was, you know, in the little was in the hot water, getting right. warmer, not jumping out of it like the little frog. But now Europe has to wake up. Europe has to exist. Europe has to have a real policy. For example, what Biden did, Inflation Reduction Act, is a very good way to put back manufacturing in the U.S. And Europe obviously should try to mimic this and try to do the same. So Trump, is a good opportunity. And we've seen that with Emmanuel Macron a lot, actually. You know, remember the first, when Trump arrived, Trump was making America great again. And Macron, just after 1 month, said, make the planet great again. So for the U.S., for the other leaders like Macron, it's also a way to empower themselves and to and hopefully take good decisions.
Véronique de Rugy, it's not just about the man who's in the Oval Office. Again, sending out these letters to French companies and other European companies, is it just a testing the waters, or does it mean that the United States has fundamentally changed and cannot be trusted by business partners on this side of the Atlantic?
Well, I think you said something which was extremely important, is that all of this, in the end, is not just about economics, and it's actually very cultural. There's a cultural rebellion here, and unfortunately, I wish they weren't trying to kind of address a lot of cultural things with economic policies, but this is what's happening. Think about, again, the tariffs, right? It's supposed to be reviving manufacturing. There are 600,000 jobs opening in manufacturing in the U.S. that cannot be filled. Their unemployment is extremely low. The economy is growing. Wages are growing. I mean, it cannot be said objectively that they're trying to really address a fundamental economic problems. But it is about men falling out of the labor force. It's about a sense of displacement. It's about a sense of what I guess they believe the left has imposed on America and try to kind of take away what they believe is American culture, and there's a backlash, and they're rebelling against this, and so this is why I'm not surprised that this is all alongside these tariffs, you also have demands that have nothing to do with the tariffs. And so, yeah, America's changing, and I think on these particular issues, like the DEI stuff, I don't know how much it is affected Europe, but it has affected America a great deal. This was something where Trump was on the 80-20% side of these issues, and the Democrats weren't. America just did not like what was going on, and now Trump is empowered, he believes, to put in place these big changes. Does it mean he has to impose them on everyone outside of the U.S.? I mean, that remains to be seen.
And that gets to something that's in your book, Edward Fishman. The U.S. doesn't want to fight more forever wars, but you show how ever since September 11th, successive U.S. governments, Democrat, Republican, have instead used sanctions oftentimes, extending that to penalties anytime the U.S. dollar is used in a transaction, even when there's no U.S. entity involved. This weaponization of the U.S. dollar, everybody was applauding it when it was taking on entities that fund jihad or rogue regimes. Now, though, that weaponization of the dollar, how far will it go?
Sure. So, look, I think that the weaponization of the dollar has clearly caused a backlash, starting even in 2014 after the Obama administration, which I was part of, imposed sanctions on Russia. Russian built what's called SPFS, which is an alternative to SWIFT. China has also built their own alternative to SWIFT called CIPS, or the Cross-Border Interbank Payment System. So initially in the 2010s, there were these sort of infrastructural layers that were being built in parallel to the dollar-based system. We also saw then in 2018, when Trump pulled out unilaterally of the Iran nuclear deal and reimposed sanctions on Iran, we saw even our closest allies, Britain, France, and Germany, build a system called Instex to try to facilitate trade with Iran without using the dollar. I think what we're seeing today is after this period where Biden had kind of repaired some of that damage and started working more multilaterally with allies, including, you know, critically sanctioning the Central Bank of Russia in 2022, which was not just a U.S. action, but a European action, a Japanese action, a British action. Trump, by imposing sanctions not just on adversaries, but also on allies, I think is really risking the future of the U.S. dollar. And we've already seen in the first couple months of the Trump's presidency, we've seen assets being moved out of the United States and into Europe. We're seeing an appreciation of the euro at the expense of the dollar. And that's somewhat counterintuitive, because normally economic theory would suggest that if you impose tariffs, your currency is going to strengthen because there's less demand in the United States for foreign currency. So I think we are starting to see the beginnings of a bit of a referendum on American financial leadership. The one thing I will note, though, is that the Trump folks are very nervous about the dollar losing its privileged position. So I'm hoping, as an American, that some sense gets into them and that they realize that if they're going to be deploying these sanctions and export controls against everybody, they really are risking the centrality of the dollar in the global financial system.
Yeah, but what's the alternative? I mean, the United States dollar has the backing of, again, a country that dominates the industry of the 21st century, which is tech, that dominates financial services, that has a huge military with all those aircraft carriers. We in France have only one, and sometimes in dry dock for reparation. What's the alternative to the U.S. dollar?
Yeah, so right now, there's not a great alternative. I'd say the closest alternative is the euro, right? In that you look at foreign exchange reserves globally, I think something like 60% are in dollars. Second place is the euro at 20%. You know, the euro is a freely convertible currency, similar to the dollar. I think what's held the euro back, frankly, is the fact that the European Union doesn't act as a joint fiscal power. They do not have a fiscal union. You don't have joint debt issuance. I think if the European Union does actually go forward with a major rearmament that leads to something like more regular euro bond issuances and joint debt issuance, you could see the euro start to rival the dollar. I'm not saying it's going to catch up, but you could see more parity. The other currency that's often talked about is the RMB. And China certainly has built out the infrastructure to allow for RMB trading. You now have an oil futures contract that's traded on the Shanghai Exchange. This is sometimes what's called the petro yuan instead of the petro dollar. You also have China building out things like a central bank digital currency, the digital RMB. The challenge, of course, that China faces is that the RMB is not a freely convertible currency. And so if you're a foreign company or a foreign government who's accumulating RMB and you know, investing in China, you can't be sure that you can get that money out. And so I think the biggest impediment for the euro challenging the dollar is the fact that Europe isn't issuing joint debt. They don't have a fiscal union. And the biggest impediment for China is the fact that, you know, China still is an authoritarian regime that has significant capital controls and doesn't have the rule of law. Final point is that the United States, I think the biggest threat to the dollar doesn't necessarily come from Europe or China. It comes from within. Because I think if Trump does systematically undermine the rule of law in the United States, or if he undermines the independence of the Federal Reserve and starts politicizing things like central bank swap lines, I do think you could see much more momentum behind de-dollarization around the world.
All right. Well, Edward, we have an Italian with us, so I'll ask him, is this the fall of the Roman Empire?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the fall of the Roman Empire took centuries. Okay, so it might be the beginning of the fall. And I join Edward in what he said. I mean, there might be alternatives, not now, but in the medium to long term, to the dollar. I also agree that the strength of the dollar comes from the strength of the U.S. economy on a wide range of things, not just the economy per se, but the fact that it's
trust. It's about trust.
It's an ecosystem that works very well.
And the rest of the world trusts the solidity of that.
And let me also say that, suppose he will not succeed, because his tariffs will not succeed in reducing the budget deficit, but the budget deficit of the United States, external debt of the United States, is the counterpart of the accumulation of dollars by the other countries of the world. So if he succeeds in reducing the deficit, there will be less demand for dollars coming from abroad. So, I mean, there is also some contradiction in what Trump is trying to do. So it will not happen tomorrow. Like the European Fiscal Union, I mean, Edward basically opened a wide open a door for me, because I've been arguing for this for many years now. These things will not happen in the very short run.
Hold on, on that point.
Let me finish. But yeah. he has set in motion. I started by saying it's a big deal because he started a process in motion, and this process might eventually lead to China to try to organize itself, to open its capital markets, and hence, at that point, provide an alternative to Europe to get its act together and act as a large, strong, and stable economy, and hence, once again, get the trust that today is reserved to the United States. And that, in 2, 3, 5, 10 years, I don't know when, might actually, yes, end up in the end of the empire. Sorry for cutting.
No, not at all. We recently had elections in Germany, and before the new parliament was seated, the old one lifted a constitutional ban on deficits. Is that the beginning of that fiscal union where you're allowed to mutualize debt more? We saw a tiny bit of it during COVID.
I smile because, I mean, I've been disappointed many times before, and so I don't know. Certainly, Germany is a key player in Europe, and the German opposition to the very concept of debt in the past 20 years has been the main obstacle to a joint issuance of debt, with the limited exception of COVID, which triggered lots of hope in many of us, including myself, and then we closed that parenthesis very quickly. Are we opening another parenthesis? And for how long that parenthesis would remain open? I don't know. The new German government is not, I mean, it's not born yet, but it will not be a strong government. And so, and Merz doesn't seem to be a very charismatic figure, and let's not forget that Merz is also very much fiscal conservative. So I'm very cautious. It is true that the repeal of the debt brake was good news. Let's see if Germany follows suit and also argues in favor of relaxing the European fiscal rules.
Véronique de Rugy, on the point that Edward Fishman made about China, he talked about capital controls, why its currency won't be the currency of reference yet. But again, there's also this sentiment of the arbitrary, right? That you need to be able to trust not only the currency, but the society is open. And if you're a foreign investor, that your money's not going to arbitrarily go away.
I agree with everything Edward said. And I think we're far from a world where the system could be displaced by other currencies. But we're not, if Trump continues this way, and we're not far from actually us ripping off the consequences of what it means to have a currency that people don't trust. We underestimate, or at least the Trump administration, I think, underestimates the gift that it is that we've had this dominant situation for a long time, and it was well deserved. It is the reflection of a system that is grounded in the rule of law, in certainty, and in a powerful economy that. You know, rewards investors and else. And I think that there's a lot of misconception about some of the problems that America has, and there are many, of course, and blaming them on the dollar. I mean, for instance, there's something we hear a lot here, which is that the only reason why we have a budget deficit is because our dollar is so strong, and also that interest rates are so low, as if there's no actually incentives within government within Congress and administration to be fiscally responsible. I mean, and destroying the place that the dollar has in the world is not going to address this problem. So there's just a lot of problem with the whole thing, and I'm extremely concerned that they may succeed. Fortunately, the American economy has proven itself to be remarkably resilient, and is just it's difficult to kind of really get the system to collapse.
Nicolas Ménon, you're the the one entrepreneur at this table. And so let me ask you, is your view of the United States changed since January the 20th?
Well, we have no plan to go to the U.S., so I'm not sure it's going to...
But has your personal view of the U.S. changed?
You know, Donald Trump talks a lot, and I like to see facts. I like to see the impact of what's going to happen. We had a lot of talk since he joined the office mid-January. Let's have a discussion in 1 year and see if we have some first result of what is it he is doing, because he's throwing a lot of different stuff, and for the time being, we can't see any results. What I'm worried about is this war in Ukraine, the crisis we had on energy, sent interest rates to the roof, and that was very bad for the global economy in Europe, in the US. And obviously, if you have this tariff war, it's not going to decrease the price, it's going to increase them, and it's going to be something that might keep the interest rate high, and it's not good for the US, it's not good for Europe, it's not good for anybody. And so we have to wait a bit more for the global economy to recover. That's my worry for the time being as an entrepreneur, because obviously it has a big impact on the purchasing power of people and of my clients, obviously.
Yeah, Edward Fishman, Véronique de Rugy was talking about the last 80 years. Has this Pax Americana been kind of an ellipse, an exception, that's just not the way history works? Or can it be prolonged?
Look, I don't think there's anything inevitable about the fact that America is forfeiting its global leadership. I do think, though, what is clear is that the paradigm is changing. We are no longer living in the post-Cold War moment of the 1990s. And one of the sort of key arguments I have in my book, Choke Points, and I don't think people fully realize, is when you're trying to understand why we have so much economic warfare today, tariffs and sanctions, every single day you pick up the newspaper, it's that we still have a global economy designed for the benign geopolitical environment of the 1990s, but we're living in a period of intense geopolitical competition. And that mismatch between an economy that's premised on peace and a geopolitical situation that is not very peaceful, I think is what's creating this tension. And I think that the challenge that the Trump administration will have here in the United States is, can they put forward a vision for a global economy that may have less integration in some aspects, particularly between the US and China? I don't think we'll remain as deeply integrated as we have in the past, but that there still is a vision for the US and Europe, and the US for democracies in Asia and Latin America and Africa, to tighten our bonds together, this notion of friendship. I think that's the best case scenario. But honestly, frankly, what we've seen in the first 2 months of the Trump administration does suggest something that looks more like autarky, which would be an abandonment of America's role as the leader of the global economy.
Francesco Saracino?
I think that let me take now the perspective of the rest of the world, and I think we should try, and it's easier said than done, of course, we should try to start thinking about how to reorganize the global multilateral system in many aspects, trade, cooperation, health matters, for example, and security.
We've just thought that globalization is inevitable, that you just become more and more interdependent.
Somebody a few months ago in a conference mentioned a strange thing that is regional globalization. Okay, so I think we might head towards something like that. Strongly integrated areas that not necessarily trade a lot with each other. But more generally, what I think is that we need multilateral organizations that are capable of functioning even when there is the opting out, and hopefully in back in a few years, of a large actor. So, for example, how to make the World Health Organization work if the United States don't contribute, not only financially. I mean, it's more profound. How to make the WTO work if the United States opt out for a moment, the World Trade Organization. So that is the challenge for the rest of the world. We should imagine multilateral organizations that manage to somehow function even with opt-outs and opt-ins of specific countries, because we live in a much more unstable environment, and today is the United States. In 5-10 years, it might be China, and who knows who will be next. So if we want to preserve a multilateral order, this needs not to have all the countries there. It needs to work even with subsets of countries. I think this is the challenge. Don't ask me how to do it, but because that is a completely different story.
Well, I will, but at a different show, because unfortunately we're out of time. Francesca Saracino, I want to thank you. I want to thank Nicolas Mélan, Edward Fishman for being with us from New York. Véronique de Rugy in the Washington suburb of Arlington, Virginia. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.